Before we get to today's show, I'd like to hear from you. This show is nothing without our listeners, and we want to make sure we provide you with what you're looking for. Our mailbox is open to all suggestions. So if you have a topic you want to learn about or a guest you want to hear from, let us know by sending us an email to jagahealthandwellness@gmail.com. That's jagahealthandwellness@gmail.com. Now, enjoy the episode.
Hi, everybody. I'm Angelo Viola.
And I'm Pete Bowman.
Now, you might know us as the hosts of Canada's favorite fishing show, but now we're hosting a podcast.
That's right. Every Thursday, Angela and I will be right here in your ears, bringing you a brand new episode of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Now, what are we going to talk about for 2 hours every week?
Well, you know there's going to be a lot of fishing.
I knew exactly where those fish were going to be and how to catch them, and they were easy to catch.
Yeah, but it's not just a fishing show. We're going to be talking to people from all facets of the outdoors, from athletes.
All the other guys would go golfing, me and Garth and Turk, and all the Russians would go fishing.
To scientists.
But now that we're reforesting and letting things, it's the perfect transmission environment for Lyme disease.
To chefs.
If any game isn't cooked properly,
marinated,
you will taste it.
And whoever else will pick up the phone.
Wherever you are, Outdoor Journal Radio seeks to answer the questions and tell the stories of all those who enjoy being outside.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the world gets louder and louder, the lessons of our natural world become harder and harder to hear, but they are still available to those who know where to listen. I'm Jerry Ouellette, and I was honored to serve as Ontario's Minister of Natural Resources. However, my journey into the woods didn't come from politics. Rather, it came from my time in the bush and a mushroom. In 2015, I was introduced to the birch-hungry fungus known as chaga, a tree conch, with centuries of medicinal applications used by Indigenous peoples all over the globe. After nearly a decade of harvest, use, testimonials and research, my skepticism has faded to obsession, and I now spend my life dedicated to improving the lives of others through natural means. But that's not what the show's about. My pursuit of this strange mushroom and my passion for the outdoors has brought me to the places and around the people that are shaped by our natural world. On Outdoor Journal Radio's Under the Canopy podcast, I'm going to take you along with me to see the places, meet the people, that will help you find your outdoor passion and help you live a life close to nature and under the canopy. So join me today for another great episode, and hopefully we can inspire a few more people to live their lives under the canopy. Okay, welcome to the show, Marco. Now, Marco's with DU, and we got DU here on the show with us to talk about some Ducks Unlimited aspects. Tell us about your position with Ducks Unlimited, Marco.
So I am the manager of volunteer and corporate fundraising in southwestern Ontario. So I manage both fundraising events and corporate fundraising all over the southwestern part of the province and into the GTA.
Okay. So southwest being which part? Runs from basically Windsor to where?
So I run basically from Windsor all the way up to Campbellford, Lakefield area,
right.
Down towards Fort Erie, and all the way up to Silvermorey.
Okay, and so what do you do in your position then in those areas, and how do you work that?
So I'm responsible for event fundraising,
right.
And we do that with our core of volunteers. So I help all of our volunteers organize our fundraising events, not right. only dinners, but also golf tournaments and peer-to-peer fundraising events, running events, motorcycle rides.
Motorcycle rides, yeah.
Anything we can think of to have, you know, a public event and fundraising.
Oh, very good. So roughly how many events would you do in your district?
So in my district, we are now currently at about 29 fundraising events.
Okay. Yeah. And what kind of, mostly dinners like they used to be?
Yeah. So mostly about 26 of mine are all fundraising dinners.
Right.
Ranging from high-end like Toronto galas to our right. grassroots, my favorite dinners, which are classic dinners, our grassroots events. And then, like I said, golf tournaments and rides and runs are our other ventures that we do, including actually sporting plays events as well. We do those too.
So the big gala you said in Toronto, what whereabouts is that located? Where do they have that?
So the big gala is down at Ritz-Carlton, right downtown in Toronto.
Yeah.
And it's going to be our 46th year this year doing that event.
And what time of the year is it every year?
It actually used to actually be end of January, but we've actually moved it to a permanent spot in mid to late April now, whatever dates are usually available.
Oh,
so
very
it's a
good
spring event now.
Okay. How long has Ducks Unlimited been around?
So Ducks Unlimited, there's two parts to that. Ducks Unlimited Incorporated has been around since 1937.
Right.
Ducks Unlimited Canada was founded in 1938.
Right.
Our fundraising program has been around for 50 years now. So,
oh, okay.
So 50 years was when our first fundraising event started. And coinciding, actually enough, it'll be this fall.
Right.
With the Long Point chapter having their 50th dinner. They'll be the first chapter that was ever started in Canada, are now doing their 50th dinner this year in September.
And it started out in Manitoba, did it not, in Canada?
Actually, no. Ducks Unlimited Canada started in Manitoba. That's where the first projects were done, which is the Duck Factory number one.
Right.
Our fundraising program actually started in Ontario. It was in Tilsonburg 50 years ago, which is now the Long Point Dinner.
And actually, here's a bit of trivia that I'm sure you don't know, but the very first volunteer for Ducks Unlimited Canada was a friend of mine. I don't know her maiden name, but it was Ursula Robson.
I know the name.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
And her father was one of the founders when it first started, and she volunteered to do the secretarial work and did all the secretarial work back in then. It was the first volunteer for Ducks Unlimited.
Fantastic.
Way back when it started, way back out in Manitoba. So What the number of Ducks Unlimited dinners, because I used to be on the Pickering Committee and there was an Oshawa Committee that I always was very active with. I know I gave grace at every single one until it closed. There's been a reduction in the number of dinners they're having out there, or since the heyday?
Yeah, well, actually, so I've been on staff for actually almost 10 years. It'll be November in 10 years. So it'll be 10 years in November, sorry. And at the time, we were in a decline. But what we have done since has actually been an uptake in our dinners. Not to where they were in the heyday, as you just mentioned, but we've increased our events. And what we've done is we have actually gone for a really high quality level of fundraising events.
Right.
Our events have just been that much better over the last couple of years. And surprisingly enough, since COVID, has been a really, really big rise in our events.
Well, there used to be so many dinners out there. I know that the Wild Turkey Foundation, the Rough Grouse Foundation, and I used to be the Minister of Natural Resources, as many of the listeners would know. I used to attend them all prior to becoming minister and afterwards, because it was a big passion of mine. And to be honest, in the 70s, that's what I wanted to do, was be the minister. And I used to attend all those dinners. But most of those organizations have all folded all their dinners. So to me, it's a great opportunity for the DU, for the Duck, as we call it, to get right back on that bandwagon again, I would hope.
Well, you know what? Absolutely. That's actually what we've done. So our rise in event attendance since the shutdown of COVID has skyrocketed. And we've seen a tremendous increase in our volunteer base with younger volunteers.
Good. That's
which
important.
Which is unbelievable and exactly what we want to see.
Yeah.
So it's so grateful that we've seen it being, I'm not a veteran, but I've been a volunteer for 18 years. So,
right.
You know, I'm of that vintage where they're almost calling me an old volunteer. So it's good to see the younger volunteers. I just started a brand new chapter in Goderich. And, you know, I don't think anyone's over the age of 30 in that committee. So
that's a good sign. You know. You're getting the youth involved. And that was one of the keys, I know, at the conferences, because I used to attend the conferences that were up in Deerhurst.
Yes. Yep.
They were up there for quite a few years. And they had a youth program. And I used to bring in, and I asked my sons who are overworking the booth here because we're at the Toronto Sportsman Show, overworking the Chaga booth for me. Well, so what should I ask? They said, what's about the youth programs? And maybe you can enlighten about some of the youth programs, because if you're getting committees that are under 30 years old, an average age, that's a good sign for a long-term impact in those communities.
There is. So we don't have an actual youth program, which was what we would have called the Green Wing program back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually before my time, but the Green Wing program was, you know, a good legacy. We do have a really good education program.
Yes.
But what we've found that we've been doing here in Ontario has been really successful is our local chapters have been running youth events. The Long Point Ladies run a Future Wetlands Protector, Future Wetlands Protectors program, and we bring in 50 kids every year, do a whole wetlands day. We have several chapters that do mentored youth hunts.
Right.
And that's, we've been doing it at the grassroots level. So, you know, hopefully in the near future, we'll have something nationally for our youth program, which is what we're looking for.
Well, I know that the committees in the area, because when I was elected, we used to have, I ran a kids fishing day.
Yes.
And we used to bring out the duck and they would run a pond demonstration and they had handouts for the kids and did all kinds of stuff. And it was a great exposure for the duck and getting youth involved. And the last time we had it, we had over 5,000 individuals in attendance at that event, which is, and we tried to provide an opportunity for kids to get outside and get away from being stuck in the house and playing their video games. And it was a great opportunity because we stocked the pond for the kids. We provide rods and reels. Not only that, but the duck came out along with a lot of other organizations and put on demonstrations, and we showed all kind of pond stuff, which was really good. But Marco, where else do you get your funding from? Is it just the fundraisers for Ducks Unlimited, or how does it work?
So we get funding from several levels. We do get provincial and federal funding. A lot of our funding comes from partnerships.
Okay.
Actually, that speaks to a lot of our success, especially here in Ontario.
Right.
A lot of our success in doing our conservation projects is done through partnerships with various conservation organizations, the GRCA being one where I'm from in Cambridge.
Right.
Just off the top of my head that I know of. We partner with these organizations to help improve the work that we do
right.
and provide more funding.
Yep.
And we also get a lot of funding from our DU Inc. counterparts.
Right.
So the DU Inc. does provide funding for wetlands work here in Canada through various programs, NACA being one of them.
Right.
Because we are the ones that produce the ducks.
Yeah, there was one program way back after I was minister before I was minister with Ducks Unlimited, it came up in the Ministry of Environment. Had a fund that Norm Sterling was the minister at the time that set a lot of funds aside and a committee to establish that. And they were kind of sitting idle until I got a ride with one of the chair of the committee from the Ministry of the Environment. And he says, yeah, we're looking for projects. And I said, I happen to know somebody. And I got in touch with Tom Warden, who is the... Tom was the president.
Yeah.
And we set up a deal. And my understanding was that the duck matched the funds in it, which mostly came from the States.
Mm-hmm.
They brought up money and they did all kind of rehabilitation projects with that funds here in Ontario. And I think we went from $5 to $10 million very quickly.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I know we had a real good push from the provincial government with the $5 million project allotment
right.
last couple of years, which has been really fantastic. And it really helps with the work we do, right?
So, okay, that's what I want to get to. What kind of work does the duck actually do?
So our mission statement and the work we do is wetlands conservation. So our main priority is to either establish new wetlands or rehabilitate wetlands that need to be brought back to life.
Right.
And that's our main course in what we do. And it spawns through, I mean, it is to help save the ducks, but it just spans to so much. In this age of carbon sequestration and climate change, doing our wetlands work is our mission.
Wetlands there's a lot more to wetlands than just ducks, though, I can recall. And actually, it may have been the duck that brought this to my attention. Maybe not, because there was so much information. But what happened was down in Florida, there was a huge problem with off-tasting water. And what happened was the water that was coming in was, the base water was just awful tasting. So they established a wetland there that filtered out all that and completely purified all the water. So it was coming through, and it was just another example. So it's not just about ducks. It's about a lot of other things as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, wetlands are nature's filter.
Yep.
You know, you see a wetland, you drive by a wetland that's just old stagnant water. It's not. It's doing its job.
Yeah. Well, last year here at the show, I was lecturing on foraging. And one of the lectures that I spoke about was cattail roots and how it worked as an antiseptic. The kind of, it almost looks like an aloe vera paste that comes out of it. And guess where you get those? Wetlands, right?
That's right.
Along with a lot of other things. So how does somebody get a project or develop a project in their area if they've got an idea? And who do they get in touch with, and how do they move that forward to make it happen for their own specific area? And how large does it need to be, or how small can it be?
Well, they vary in size, but in terms of reaching out, you can reach out to any of our offices. We have an office in Barrie and also in Kingston. They can always reach out to me, Marco Cunha, 226 220-0990, and I can always forward you to the right people.
Right.
Our conservation team, we have an extensive conservation team, but what we do is we assess your project through our team, and then they'll determine the scale and whether it's a viable project or whether it's not.
Right.
And if it is, then we will then look at funding and how to proceed.
So how big can projects be or how small can they be?
So projects can range from anywhere from a small pairing pond, which could be a small 1 to 2 acre little pairing pond,
right,
to massive 3 to 4 acre wetland projects.
Right.
So there really is no minimum or maximum amount. It's if the project is viable, we would look at what could be done.
And how long do they last? Like, so you come into an agreement with somebody you want to build. And I know Mr. Armstrong had a duck pond up just south of Lindsay in Ontario that was developed by Ducks Unlimited. And how long is an agreement for that area to maintain that do you know what I'm,
yep,
do they
yeah.
still have that?
Yep. So actually our natural lifespan of a healthy wetland is usually, I would probably say between 20 and 30 years.
Right.
So usually at the 30 year mark, you're looking at probably a rebuild project.
Right.
That's actually one of our biggest features that we're doing now.
Okay.
We're at an era where a lot of projects are being rebuilt. So our conservation team has spent a lot of time over the last few years rebuilding those 30 plus year old projects.
Okay. So Marco, what kind of a project would it be? Like, what is it? Do you're digging holes in the ground, you're damming up streams, or what do you do?
Well, so a rebuild project would consist of basically rebuilding the water control structures. There would be a drawdown purpose, a drawdown kind of term, bring the water level down, rebuild the control structure. And then what that does is exposes those years of sediment that have settled, let natural vegetation regrow. And then the wetland, we would let them naturally fill in again.
Right.
And then you start the process of another healthy wetland.
So do you bring in plants, natural plants, or do you just let it naturalize on its own?
Mostly it's natural. We do a lot of times on the control structures, we do have seeding programs.
Okay.
Our conservation team would have more knowledge on that than I would, but there's various options that can be done.
Right. I was up at Hearst, and I remember, I can't remember the name. It could be the Cap River up that way, where my understanding was that Ducks Unlimited worked with them when they were putting in a hydro dam there and had wild rice all planted through there. And so there was a lot of duck support in other ways,
right,
rather than just putting in structures, but also supporting the wildlife or the faunage and the food forage base for a lot of them.
The food source, absolutely.
Right.
I mean, wild rice is, it's the duck's favorite meal. So.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of things. So what about, do you know much about duckweed and things like that? Are those things that you can bring in, or how do you introduce those into an area?
So I personally don't have as much knowledge on that as our conservation team would, but I know, I mean, duckweed obviously is basically the same. You know, it's heaven for duck food and establishment, but our conservation team would know more and how to source those seeds, because that's how they work with our suppliers. And doing that for the conservation side.
And what about flooded woodlands? Do they do that sort of stuff as well? Or is that something that is a seasonal thing? I don't much know much about it, but I know.
So I don't know much about it. I would say, from my personal experience, probably more of a seasonal thing. That's not really something I have seen our conservation team do too much of in flooded woodlands.
Right.
But I mean, I actually have a flooded woodland on my neighbor's property, which is a natural occurring little spot. It's kind of a little bit of piece of heaven back there. So,
oh, okay.
So it literally does its own thing every year and floods naturally. And
now it's time for another testimonial for Chaga Health and Wellness. Hi, it's Jerry from Chaga Health and Wellness. We're here in Lindsay with Tula, who is actually from Finland and uses Chaga. Tula, you've had some good experiences with Chaga. Can you just tell us what that experience is?
Yes, I got sick with fibro, and one weekend, my husband came here alone. I was home, and he brought your leaflet.
Right.
And I read it, and I said, next weekend when we go to a market, we're going to buy it some. And so we started putting it in our morning smoothie.
Right.
And among a few other things that I was doing because of that, the Chaga has been the steady one.
Right.
I would not want to live without it.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So it's been working for me.
Very good.
Lots of ways.
And you had some good luck with blood pressure as well.
Oh, right. Yeah. thanks for remembering that. That's I had a little bit of high elevated blood pressure, and within 2 weeks of starting that every day, every morning, it went to normal.
And you think the chaga was the reason why?
Well, I didn't do anything else in that time frame.
Yeah. Oh, very good. And so how much chaga did you have, and how did you have it?
Well, we just put that powder in a smoothie.
Right.
Know, yeah. And it's about tablespoon.
Yeah.
No, it's less than tablespoon for
teaspoon?
Two of us. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you don't need that much.
Right. About a teaspoon, yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, thanks very much for sharing that. We really appreciate that and wish you all the best with the chaga. Oh, you're from Finland as well. And chaga is pretty popular in Finland, is it not?
I think it probably is because there's some professors in a university that's teaching it and talking about it. And, of course, it's big in Russia.
Right.
Because that's where, you know, the northern woods that comes from.
Yep.
Yeah. And, of course, Finland has lots of birch trees.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's so the only mushroom that you can't forage in Finland. Love to forage everything else, but not chaga.
Oh, very good. Well, thanks very much for sharing that. Okay, have a great day.
You too.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special offer from Chaga Health and Wellness. If you've listened this far and you're still wondering about this strange mushroom that I keep talking about, and whether you would benefit from it or not, I may have something of interest to you. To thank you for listening to the show, I'm going to make trying chaga that much easier by giving you $1 off all our chaga products at checkout. All you have to do is head over to our website, chagahealthandwellness.com, place a few items in the cart, and check out with the code CANOPY, C-A-N-O-P-Y. If you're new to chaga, I'd highly recommend the regular chaga tea. This comes with 15 tea bags per package, and each bag gives you around 5 or 6 cups of tea. Hey, thanks for listening. Back to the episode.
Maybe you could tell us a bit, Marco, about the difference between a puddle duck and a diver duck.
Absolutely. Well, puddle ducks are basically what you hear, you know, a little puddle duck, like your mallards, your pintails, your gadwalls. Those are mallards. Ducks that'll sit in smaller bodies of water, their feet are more inset into their body, more apt to be on land, whereas diver ducks are more big open water ducks that'll dive for food sources,
right.
And they are not really suited for land. You'll see their legs are far set on their body, but really built for diving in deep water, like canvasbacks, redheads, bluebills, and longtails.
So most of your projects, are they for puddle ducks or diver ducks? Or do you have projects that do both?
Well,
I don't know many diver. I never thought about that. Is there diver projects or not?
Well, if you come into the smaller wetlands, like herring ponds, like the 1 to 2 acre ones, those are puddle duck projects.
Yes.
But if you do a project that could be larger, that would hold more of a water source, you'll see diver ducks.
Right.
In the prairies is where you'll see most of that. Here in Ontario, you don't see too much of that inland. Divers are... You'll see them on the Great Lakes or bigger water bodies on rivers.
Right.
But if you go to the prairies, a lot of our wetlands projects, they're home to thousands of divers.
So in the prairies now, it's very different for development and projects. Are you familiar with the projects that take place in the prairies because of all the small potholes that fill up and produce or not?
Yeah, I don't have much experience with the prairies. I've hunted there.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful area. I love to be there. I don't know how much experience on how they do their projects there, but they're very similar to the way we do it here. A lot of our work is done through partnerships with landowners, farmers, and of the sort. So keep those little water holes, I guess you'd call them, the prairie potholes,
right,
that are viable. We do a lot of those projects there as well.
So is there incentives for individuals to retain wetlands that works with Ducks Unlimited? Because I see a lot of areas where they will kind of get rid of the wetlands. I know there's one close to us in Whitby where I keep looking and wondering, are they going to fill that in or not? Or is there incentives for them to maintain them? Or is it just something that the local landowner has to make a decision on? Or is it something that you know, of projects or funding available to retain the wetlands?
So those are all done on a project by project basis.
Okay.
So not any project is the same. So when our conservation team looks at doing a wetlands project, those are all questions that are asked and answered on a project by project basis. So some may qualify for incentives and funding, some may not.
Right.
So that would be up to the team and the landowner or whoever's helping with the project.
Very good. So tell us about duck banding. Does Ducks Unlimited get in banding, and do you participate? Do you support? How does it take place? And what do you do if you happen to harvest a duck with a band on it?
Yeah, so Ducks Unlimited doesn't actually do banding itself. Duck banding is done through the Canadian Wildlife Service.
Okay.
Although we do support it wholeheartedly, it's actually one of the most amazing ways of tracking waterfowl and learning migration routes. What we've done in the past is we do get, that's actually one of our number one questions. People who ask, you know, can we do a banding project with Ducks Unlimited? So we don't do it, we do forward them over to the appropriate CWS contacts that we have.
Right.
In terms of what they should do with the band, obviously, if you ever come across a bird with a band, whether it's found dead or if you're hunting and get a band, or even if you find a live bird and you can read the band numbers, you can actually report them online.
Right.
And that information is crucial for various things that the CWS does in terms of controlling populations, doing research on
flight routes,
flight routes and migration paths,
right,
and also establishing limits for waterfowl seasons.
And is that what they use a lot of the funds, or do you know from the waterfowl stamps?
So as far as I know, waterfowl stamping, the funds from that go towards banding and conservation
right
initiatives in general.
Okay. Now, so do you do work in Mexico as well?
So DU de Mexico is also a third organization.
Right.
So DU de Mexico does a lot of work. One place I would love to go and learn more about, because I don't know much about the work that DU Mexico does,
right,
but they actually are a very strong partner with DU Inc. Because not only is Canada important for breeding populations, Mexico is a very important staging area for
right
the millions of waterfowl that migrate. So DU Mexico does a lot of work with DU Inc. to keep precious wetlands down there viable for staging waterfowl.
Yeah, the Migratory Bird Act was signed between Canada, the States, and Mexico, and that limits the number of days and places and times that can be hunted in order to protect wildfowl. But I can't remember. It's like 1917, 1911, something like that.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the Waterfowl Treaty Act, I believe, or a variation of the name.
Right.
And it's basically, like you said, agreement between all three, Mexico, U.S., and Canada.
Right.
And they do a really good job of managing those dates.
So I got a really weird question for you, because I don't have the answer. And it just pops in all the time. But when the birds fly south and they're in Mexico and that, do they nest then and lay eggs?
Well, I would say the local population does.
The ones locally?
The local ones do, yeah.
Because I didn't know if they nest here in Ontario and in Canada.
Yeah.
And then when they fly south, are they nesting again or not? Or is it just once a year?
No.
I don't really know.
No, you would see that it's funny because going back to the banding project,
right,
you find out so many interesting things about waterfowl. A lot of people think that, you know, come winter, fall, birds just migrate south.
Right.
And then they migrate north again. But a lot of times you'll see a lot of reverse migrations here and there. So, you know, some birds that are born in the southern states actually migrate north.
Oh, really?
And vice versa. So I would say sometimes a lot of birds that migrate from here don't make it back and become established residents in the south and breed there.
So I imagine, like, this year being a very low moisture year. I know I talked last week to a friend of mine, Pierre, up near Timmins, Ontario. And last year he had 4 to 5 feet of snow in the bush. Mm-hmm. He's got 5 or 6 inches of snow in the bush.
Yeah.
So that's going to have huge impact on the wetlands. And unless we get huge rains in April and May, mm-hmm, and that'll affect the duck population substantially, will it not?
Yes, it will. So I've been following this myself, not only in the prairies, but here as well, just seeing the lack of snow cover, as you mentioned it.
Right.
So it will have an impact. That's actually why it's so important to have established wetlands that are healthy.
Right.
Because, you know, wetlands will hold water. So the more healthy wetlands we have in our province, the better chance we have of holding water in those years that are dry, such as the ones we're going to come see here.
Right.
We don't know how the spring is going to be for weather. If we get lots of rain, you know, that might help. But in terms of snow melt, yeah, we're going to definitely see a decrease in water levels. We're already seeing that in the prairies. We've seen the graphs of the red and purples that aren't looking good. So we're keeping our fingers crossed for a wet spring.
Hopefully so. So does the duck get involved in things like nesting boxes or providing plans for them or putting them out or nesting sites, platforms and things like that? And
yeah, so actually we do have plans on our website. If you go on ducks.ca, okay. And if you can just type in the search bar nest box, we actually have a really informative PDF file you can download.
Right.
We have a lot of volunteer programs where local chapters will build nest boxes and put them out. And it kind of becomes a yearly tradition to go out and do nest boxes. We do have a lot of our own nest box programs that have been put out over the years. And those have been managed by different volunteer groups and different staff members. As of right now, there's no established nest box program.
Okay.
We have so many out. We have... I have 8 in my area that I do as kind of a fun thing with my volunteers.
Right.
And we have a lot of chapters that do that. So
now do they need to be cleaned out every year?
Yes, they do. So the best time of year to clean out nest boxes is in late winter, usually January, February, whenever you get a good frozen pond cover. Mm-hmm. That's our favorite. This year was kind of tricky to get that. We didn't have that. So right. We had to pick our days. But yeah, we go in there every, you know, early spring, open them up. What we do, me as a group and some volunteers, is we inspect them, check for shells, check for critters living in there. You know, screech owls love to be in there in the winter, so we find some of them in there, and we clean them up, put in fresh wood shavings in, close them back up, put them back, get the predator guards back up, and keep them fresh for the spring.
Now, what about putting duck boxes in, say, stormwater retention ponds? Is that something that's encouraged or not? Or is it a way to look at to bring in? Because I'm seeing more and more migratory birds that are coming and staying in these stormwater retention ponds all the time. But is it a place that could be utilized for nesting or not? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm actually not sure on myself. I see the same thing. I've seen them. If you drive up the highway, you see all those stormwater. But what I find is I see a lot of geese on those.
Right.
Not so much waterfowl in terms of ducks and whatnot. So they don't need those themselves. We find with the nest box program, they're more for tree cavity nesting birds, so wood ducks, hooded mergansers. So those would be better suited for secluded wetlands near tree lots or wooded areas,
right?
Or just in, you know, general wetlands. So they would be better suited for what I just mentioned, not more for the stormwater areas.
Yeah, and there's been quite an explosion in geese as well.
Oh, absolutely.
So how does that impact? Do geese deter other ducks, for example, from nesting in the same areas? Or because they can be pretty aggressive.
Yeah, they can be. Actually, the most aggressive ones are actually swans.
Yes.
Swans are actually the ones that we aren't big fans of when it comes to that, because they can be very territorial. But But yeah, in terms of, I mean, the goose population, actually, that's a success story in itself. I know growing up in the 80s, you were lucky to see a goose.
Yeah.
So in terms of having them around, I know a lot of people find them to be huge pests and, you know, cottagers despise them. But, you know, for me, I love knowing that, you know, that goose population's up there and you see hundreds of them flying south in the fall. So,
yeah, there was one of my friends that developed, they worked with a fertilizer because a lot of golf courses have problems with geese everywhere.
Absolutely.
And what this fertilizer does is it produces a pheromone or that chases the geese, so keeps them away. And what they do is, Rob Sampson. He was an MPP, a cabinet minister as well, and then worked with a company that developed this. And they use it in a lot of areas such as airports where they want to keep geese away from, or golf courses in high areas that traffic that they're not attracted to, as one of the ways to try and deter them. But there are ways to look at trying to manage geese, but there are a lot of them out there compared, like you said, back in the 80s and in the 60s and 70s when I grew up, it was something rare. Hey, we saw a Canada goose today. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now it's like you don't even think about it because you see them every single day if you want.
Yeah. I'm curious if that fertilizer program works. I haven't heard much of that myself, so I'll be curious to see if...
They developed in the East Coast, and Rob Sampson is his name, and I spoke to him quite extensively because there was another individual, what was his name, Mike Meeker, up on Manitoulin Island was doing something similar to that. That had a program that was very effective, supposedly. So we tried it and tested it on a couple of areas, but I wasn't in it long enough to know whether how successful it was.
Yeah. It's a tough program. I mean, I've seen everything from, firecrackers and zip ties to strings. Those geese, they're persistent.
Yeah. Well, Marco, thanks very much for taking the time to be here today. I know it's busy here we are at the Toronto Sportsman Show. And really appreciate you coming down on behalf of Ducks Unlimited. But how do people get in touch with you and how can they find out more information about Ducks Unlimited?
Oh, well, so you can find us on all our social media platforms, Facebook, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Ontario, Instagram, same name. For a more direct route, like I mentioned earlier, you can actually call me directly. My phone's always on and I'm always willing to talk to anyone about ducks, 226-220-0990. Or you can just reach out to our either Barry office or Kingston office. Just Google our name and those numbers pop up and we can direct you to whoever you need to speak to.
Well, thanks very much, Marco. Now, one more last piece of trivia for you. You probably didn't know this, but at the conference at the Deer Center when I was minister, Tom Warden, who was president again, they presented me with an honorary degree in ducks for the work that I've done with Ducks Unlimited, and they called me Dr. Duck.
Nice, Dr. Duck. There you go. that's a moniker you keep. Keep it a special place because, there's only other one person we call Dr. Duck. His is Dr. Dunk Sinclair. I call him Dr. Dunk.
That's right.
And he was actually one of the pioneers 50 years ago. So that's great. You're in a small class of genuine people. I love it.
Yeah, Dr. D. Thanks again, Marco, for taking the time to be here. We really appreciate you. And enjoy the Sportsman Show. I'm sure we're going to have a great time for all those that are listening.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jerry.
Okay,
appreciate
thanks.
It.
What brings people together more than fishing and hunting?
How about food?
I'm Chef Antonio Maleca, and I have spent years catering to the stars. Now, on Outdoor Journal Radio's Eat and Wild podcast, Louise, Hookset, and I are bringing our expertise
and Rolodex to our real passion, the outdoors.
Each week, we're bringing you inside the boat, tree stand, or duck blind and giving you real advice that you can use to make the most out of your fishing game.
You're going to flip that duck breast over once you get a nice hard sear on that breast. You don't want to sear the actual meat. And it's not just us chatting here. If you can name a celebrity, we've probably worked with them. And I think you might be surprised who likes to hunt and fish.
When Kit Harington asks me to prepare him sashimi with his bass, I couldn't say no.
Whatever Taylor Sheridan wanted, I made sure I had it.
Burgers, steak, anything off the barbecue. That's a true cowboy.
All Jeremy Renner wanted to have was lemon ginger shots all day.
Find Eating Wild now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.